Hello, and thanks for listening to the Ordinary Philosophy Podcast. Here, you can listen to interviews and audio renditions of pieces published at Ordinary Philosophy's website, dedicated to philosophy and the public square, and the history of ideas that change the world. For more about Ordinary Philosophy, and to discover the sources and inspiration for each piece, please visit ordinaryphilosophy.com. Ordinary Philosophy's website and podcast are independent and ad-free, and depend on support from patrons and listeners like you. To find out more about how you can contribute to Ordinary Philosophy, please visit the Subscribe, Submit, and Support page and donate today. And if you enjoy what you read and hear at Ordinary Philosophy, please share with those you believe will enjoy it too, and take a moment to rate and review this podcast on iTunes. I'm Amy Cools, creator and editor of Ordinary Philosophy. I'm honored and excited to introduce my next guest for Ordinary Philosophy's 58th podcast episode, Ken Morris. We spoke on June 3rd, just before I left on a short vacation visiting some national parks, Zion, Bryce Canyon, and Yosemite. I highly recommend you go if you haven't yet. So pardon the delay in preparing and publishing our conversation. Ken Morris is closely linked to Frederick Douglass, are the subject of my most recent History of Ideas travel series, and carries on his legacy by working in a noble and very important cause. But I'll stop here and let him tell you all about it.
My name is Ken Morris. I'm president of the Frederick Douglass Family Initiatives and a direct descendant of both Frederick Douglass and Booker T. Washington.
Wonderful. That is quite incredible. I was taking a glance at your family tree, and just because I'm working on a series about Frederick Douglass, I happen to have it fresh in my mind, the family tree, a little bit. And it looks like you were descended on that side, or from the Frederick Douglass family, through Joseph, who was the violinist, correct?
Joseph is Frederick Douglass's grandson. Mm-hmm. He is my great grandfather, and yes, he's the violinist.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. That's just something neat I learned about Frederick Douglass. I just recently wrote a little bit about that, and I'll be writing more about Joseph in a future account from my travels.
That I was going to say, that's great. In fact, I just found online a photograph of Joseph and my great-grandmother, Fanny Douglass. It's a beautiful picture that I had never seen before, and I sent it to my mother to see if she had seen it. My mother, by the way, is the person that united the bloodlines of the Douglass and Washington families through the union of her parents, which I'm sure we can talk about in just a little bit. But yeah. If you get a chance, I can definitely send you a link to this photograph. It's one that we had never seen before. My mom had never seen it before either, and it's really cool. And just the way that Fanny Douglass, my great-grandmother, and Joseph met was at Oberlin College in Ohio, where Fanny was a music student. And Joseph was, of course, a violinist. He was a concert violinist playing classical music. And he came to Oberlin to play a concert. And because Fanny was the most accomplished pianist at the school, she was chosen to accompany him. And they met at that concert, fell madly in love, and wound up getting married. So I guess in a way you could say I owe my existence to that violin.
Wow, that is a great story. Wow. Well, okay. So a little bit about Booker T. Washington. You're not quite as far back, of course, because Booker T. Washington was born a little later, maybe 30 years after Douglass himself. So we'll talk more about both men and their contributions. But I wanted to get your background, how you came to this. I read in the Washington Post, there was a Washington Post story that told quite a bit about you, or your an educator, a traveler, a performer, an entrepreneur. You live in Corona, right?
Well,
I'm from Riverside, so I went there a lot.
My wife and I and my girls have lived in Corona for many, many years. We're now in the Orange County area of Southern California now.
Okay, yeah, I was born in Orange. That's my old stomping grounds, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Then you know exactly where we are.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to today. An overview, I guess.
Yeah, well, I as you said, I've done quite a few things, and you know, right out of high school, I got with a group called the Young Americans, which was a performing group that toured the world, and in fact, that's where my wife Diana and I met when we were teenagers. We had an opportunity to, at the age of 18 years old, to fly to Cannes, France, two summers in a row, and spend several months each summer over there performing on the French Riviera. Not a bad place to actually have your first dating experience.
And yeah. Oh, yeah. She
yes, she no may kidding. Say everything went downhill after that, but we just, a couple of weeks ago, celebrated 32 years of marriage. So
it
definitely worked out. And from there, I pursued performing and sang for a little while with a guy by the name of Howard Hewitt, who was the lead singer of a group called Shalimar. And they had some hits in the 80s. And then he had his own solo career and was very successful singing R&B music. And I toured with him for a little while. And my wife actually at the time started to become very successful and started to perform on Broadway. And so her career really took off as far as being on the stage. And mine, I kind of segued into business. Mm-hmm. I was always an entrepreneur and always thinking about business ideas. And with a friend of mine that I used to work for, who owned a hotel marketing company, he and I started our own marketing firm, and we did work in the travel industry, and we catered mostly toward cruise lines. We developed marketing programs to get corporations interested in bringing their conventions, their meetings, and their incentives on the ships that and cruise lines that we recommended. And I did that for about 20 years, and all the while, never really was that connected to my lineage. You know, I talk about being younger, and the few times that I told my classmates of my relationship to Douglas and Washington, nobody ever believed me. Uh-huh. And I never thought that it was a point worth arguing. So I really spent most of my life kind of running away from the legacy. I'd seen what the pressure had done to those that came before me. And I certainly knew the importance of my ancestors, because I spent all of my summers in Frederick Douglass's beach house on the Chesapeake Bay, and all of their images were around me when I was growing up. So I knew of their importance and contributions to the country and to the world, but never celebrated it or really embraced it until about 7 or 8 years ago, when I was introduced to the issue of human trafficking and modern day slavery through a National Geographic magazine and cover story called 21st Century Slaves.
And I've heard that there are probably more slaves in the world, maybe by a good bit today, than there were in the time of Frederick Douglass and Booker T. Washington. Is that true?
It is true. Yeah, it definitely is true. Now, there are, of course, more people on the planet today, and that would be one of the contributing factors. But, you know, in the 19th century, when the Emancipation Proclamation was signed, and then we had the ratification of the 13th Amendment, there were 4 million enslaved Americans that were freed. And because it was legal, it was state sanctioned, we knew exactly how many slaves there were. Today, it's not legal anywhere in the world, but it exists in every country around the world. So it's now an underground illegal activity. And it's very hard to count what you can't see. So if you're researching numbers and statistics, you'll see as many as 12 or as low as 12 million slaves around the world, and all the way up to 45.8 million, which is a new number that just came out a couple of days ago. So
wow.
When you see a wide range like that, what that really tells us is that we don't know how many people are enslaved because of the clandestine nature of the activity, clandestine mm-hmm. nature of the activity. But we know that it's in the millions, and today's slavery affects the most vulnerable. So that means that there are more women and children that are enslaved.
That leads me to ask, maybe to take an imaginative leap, what do you think, in turn, or both Frederick Douglass and Booker T. Washington would say about that today? Just given the changed nature, what do you think they might comment on, maybe what makes it different? Is it better or worse? Is it evil in a different way or the same way? And so on.
That's a question I get a lot. What would Frederick Douglass and Booker T. Washington say if they were here today about all of the social ills that still afflict us today? And of course, it's hard to know mm-hmm. what they would say, but we can certainly look back at their writings, the speeches that they gave. And Frederick Douglass was the great abolitionist and freedom fighter and his goal was to end slavery, and slavery still exists. So I imagine that he still would be he would be fighting against slavery today. Booker T. Washington was the great educator and founder of Tuskegee Institute, now Tuskegee University, and so education was important to him. And that's the reason that we combine the legacies of abolition through education to go about how we address contemporary forms of slavery today. As far as evil, evil is evil. So I can't really say that one is worse than the other. But if you boil down the basic elements of historic slavery and what that was about, and boil down the basic elements of contemporary forms of slavery, you'll see that those are basically the same. It's about profit. It's about money. It's about exploiting the most vulnerable. And in doing so, you're brutalizing, dehumanizing, and doing all of the things that were done in the slavery that we're most familiar with. And those tactics are still used today in contemporary forms of slavery.
So speaking of tactics, I would look at the approaches of both men, and some were different for sure. Frederick Douglass was very much wanted to break down walls and wanted society to be very free, very open, without kind of erasing the separations between us, and kind of seeing that if we see one another as human beings, that we would be moved to compassion and sympathy that would make such an institution distasteful for us, both personally and socially. Booker T. Washington focused a little bit more on community, education. Both men were focused on education. But for example, one of the stances that Booker T. Washington was that he took that's more controversial today is that he was okay with segregation for the reason that it could foster close-knit communities that shared a common destiny, background, circumstances, and maybe that he might see, like maybe the very openness of the world today makes us complacent with the idea that we know. So, for example, we should know about slavery because it's an open society as far as we know, or world society. But obviously, it's not because it keeps going on. Do you think that Washington might have something there with his approach?
He absolutely had something there with his approach, and you also have to consider the time and the environment that he was in. So, you mentioned that Booker T. Washington was a generation younger than Frederick Douglass, so their goals really were different. Frederick Douglass's goal was the abolition of slavery, and really he was the father of the civil rights movement. And then comes Booker T. Washington, who understood that now we have 4 million people that were enslaved. Most didn't know how to read and write because it was illegal to teach a slave to read and write. They had been separated from their families. They didn't have money. They didn't own land. They didn't have businesses. And there was really no plan for emancipation. There was no counseling. There was no post-traumatic stress order designation. So Washington understood that education had to start with the basics. And his concern was, how do I uplift my race? How do I uplift a race of people? And so education for him meant starting with hygiene. He felt that you couldn't start reaching for the higher aims in life, for the higher education, until you could start meeting your basic needs in life. So he would start with teaching them how to tie their shoes, how to brush their teeth. But what he did most importantly was he taught them something that they could do, like how to farm the land, dressmaking, taught them how to make bricks so that they could build their own school, and taught them, entrepreneurship, because he understood that we're coming out of race-based slavery, and you're not going to get people just to change their minds and attitudes about race. I mean, racism was on the surface, and it was intense. Mm-hmm. So he felt like if I could teach them something to do, give them a tool, give them a stake in the nation's growing economy, and then rather than just demanding that the white race just change their ways, Booker T. Washington showed freed African Americans how they could change themselves and how they could overcome obstacles, develop strength of character, and rise by their own efforts to honorable positions of respect, but most importantly, self-esteem. So Washington's importance really at that time was he was the person that bridged the gap between the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation and the Civil Rights Movement. So again, we have to consider the time in which he lived to understand his philosophy at that time.
Yeah, and it seems like there's a bit of a back and forth there, where for Frederick Douglass, you know, it was that initial big push for a broad political solution, which to accomplish it meant promoting ideas that were very similarly broad about human rights, about what it means to be a citizen and a person, and including in a legal sense. And then it seemed like Washington was like, okay, not maybe specifically, but recognizing, okay, there's something that hasn't been addressed. The day-to-day solutions of like, how, okay, now we're free. Well, how do you get a job? How do you have strong families and communities in populations that have been forcibly scattered and family ties were not legally recognized or sanctioned or respected? You know, if you could be sold away or taken wherever, you know, your kids could be taken. Do you think that to solve the problem of slavery today, or probably problems, because every place where it happens, I'm sure, has their own unique situations, political, mm-hmm. social, racial, whatever. Where do you think we need to start, perhaps? Do you think that Frederick Douglass or Booker T. Washington's approach might be best to start with right now to address the problem?
Well, we absolutely believe it's the best approach. Mm-hmm. You know, both of those men were born slaves. They were born into the most horrific conditions that a human being could be subjected to, but both understood at very young ages that education equaled freedom. Now, Frederick Douglass never spent one day of his life in a classroom again because it was illegal to teach a slave how to read and write. Booker T. Washington benefited from the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation, and he was 9 years old, and he was able to go to school finally at 9 years old, and Frederick Douglass was enslaved until he was 20. But the key to the work that we do in going about fighting against slavery today has everything to do with Frederick Douglass. And you may remember the story of how he was born on the eastern shore of Maryland on a plantation. And at the age of 9 years old, he was selected mm-hmm. from among all of the children on the plantation to go to Baltimore to be the house servant for his master's brother. And when he got to Baltimore, he was in a big city. He was going to be around free black children that knew how to read, and he was around white children. But what happened most importantly was his slave mistress had never had slaves before, and she didn't know that it was illegal to teach him to read and write. So she began to teach him his ABCs. And when her husband found out about it, when Frederick's master found out, he got angry and he forbade it. He said, "You cannot teach a slave how to read and write, because if you do, it will unfit him to be a slave." And Frederick looked at his master, and he heard him loud and clear, and he said, "If he doesn't want me to have this education," then he understood right then and there that knowledge was power, and it would be his key to freedom. And that one story is at the foundation of everything that we do at the Frederick Douglass Family Initiatives. We believe that through institutionalized education or knowledge, and if we're going to educate the public on the existence of human trafficking, then we have to start where education should start, and that's with young people, who, by the way, are most vulnerable to becoming victims or perpetrators of crimes of labor trafficking and sex trafficking. So through education, we believe that we can unfit communities to allow slavery to thrive and exist. So education, in our mind, is key to everything when addressing not only modern-day slavery and human trafficking, but all of the other social ills that are afflicting our communities here in the United States, but also, you know, in villages and other parts of the world. Education is key.
And then that leads me to the economics, you know, because that would be part of the education, is knowing what funds it, because again, you wouldn't keep slaves unless you were driven by a profit motive. There would be no reason. It would be difficult. Right. It's expensive. And I think for most human beings, if there wasn't another motive driving them that was more powerful, they would find it distasteful. They know it's wrong, but you know, we overcome that sometimes, or we again, not overcome it, squash it when we don't allow that better angel of our nature to take precedence.
Yes.
So anyway, but going back to the economics, we're left in the tricky position of both wanting to make the good things of the world affordable to more people. Prices want to go down. We want better things. We want more things. But it's the very economic choices we make that drive prices down, that cause people to the rush to the bottom of, for pricing. That is the what we're chasing when we enslave people, because it's like, well, if it needs to be cheaper, I don't want less money. So who bears the brunt of that? Virtually always the workers, unless you automate. So what do we do about that? What do we, is it up to us as individuals to just stop buying all this stuff? Is it up to governments? Because that's maybe impossible. So it's just up to governments to stop it on their own. What do you think?
It's a combination of all of that. But one of my favorite Frederick Douglass quotes is, it's easier to build strong children than to repair broken men. Mm-hmm. And we believe that if we're going to get out in front of this issue, we're best building strong children. When you consider sex trafficking, and we all know our economic formula of supply and demand,
yeah.
If we're going to reduce the demand, how about teaching young boys at an age when they're still forming their identity and their character and who they're going to become, that their choices and decisions they make, if they make the wrong decisions, become a part of the problem, and we want them to become a part of the solution. So we had a project called Globalize 13, which was based on the 150th anniversary of the 13th Amendment, which we just commemorated this past December. Mm-hmm. All of our curricula that we deliver to the classroom has a service component to it. And because of my unique connection to history, every project is based on the foundation of history. So with Globalize 13, it was the 13th Amendment. And our formula is called History, Human Rights, and the Power of One. So in the curricula, we start with history. In this case, we talked about the 13th Amendment, the importance of it. What did it mean to freedom? What did it mean to those that were enslaved? Does it have any application to slavery today? Can we dust it off and take it off the shelf and use it today? For the human rights portion, we talked about child labor in the supply chains of the products that we use and consume every day. So students were learning about American consumerism, and do we become a part of the problem? Are we complicit in allowing slavery to thrive and exist because we demand to buy products so cheaply? We want to go and we want to get a nice product, a piece of clothing, but we want to get the best price for it. So are we thinking about that supply chain way down the line? And because of globalization and sending all of these jobs and contracts to other countries, we've got contractors that are way down the line that are using slave labor to produce these products. For instance, in our chocolate, you have boys in Ghana that are harvesting the cocoa that goes into our chocolate. Boys on Lake Volta in Ghana that are catching the fish, and they're swimming in disease-infested water to catch the fish that goes into our seafood. And we can go all around the world. In India, the rugs that we stand on, and little girls doing close needlework because their hands are small enough to do that. So when we can talk to students and get them to start thinking critically about their decisions and choices, and they become the teachers with their parents too. And I think you'll agree that because we're through technology and the internet, we're connected now. A young person can hear about an atrocity that happens on the other side of the world instantly, and they can look at that and they can say that that's not right. So what we do in our teaching is we go back and forth from history to contemporary issues, and we'll ask, for instance, a question. If you lived in the 19th century and you were in a free state like Ohio and you wanted to buy a t-shirt, now, this is during the 19th century. You want to buy a t-shirt. You want to get a t-shirt that is good quality, that's cotton, and you put it on and you say, wow, the cotton feels soft, and I got a great deal for this shirt. Were you thinking about how that cotton was harvested and who in the South was being exploited and brutalized and dehumanized to make that t-shirt? Well, these are the same questions that we want students to ask today. And what we found with young people and we've come into contact with tens of thousands over the 8 years that we've been doing this work, when they hear about these types of things, they won't stand for it. And they'll do things like letter writing campaigns to corporations, or they'll go to their local markets and make sure that all of the products in there, that none of them have been produced with slave labor, that they're fair trade products. And they raise awareness. They go on TV, they go on the radio, they do art exhibits, they do music exhibits, they do documentaries, and they're teaching their community about these issues so that as a community, they can make better choices and think about their actions and how it feeds into the exploitation of people. So with that formula that I mentioned, history, human rights, and the power of one are the service projects that the students do in their community that I just talked about.
You mentioned the, you know, seafood trade, cocoa trade, clothing. The problem seems so massive that it seems it can make one feel helpless. I know oftentimes I will look at it and be like, oh man, how can I even make a dent? Or where do I even start? Like, it seems so pervasive. What would you recommend to people like who are just like, oh man, almost like frozen to inaction because they can't decide where to start? There's so many places to start. What would you say would be the maybe half dozen worst offenders in the world when it comes to the industries that exploit the most slave labor? What would be some that so people can have a place to start and feel like, okay, well, I'll start here, do the research, make the choices, and then go from there?
Well, the first thing to do if you want to learn about the issue is just to start researching it. And I would never tell somebody and direct them to a certain area of the problem, because what we teach young people is we want them to use their passion, their intellect, their talents. How can you take what you have and contribute to making a difference? And then when they think about it in that way, it doesn't seem like such a massive problem. Imagine if people like Frederick Douglass were to look at something, or he would have made the decision that once he ran away from slavery, once he had the courage to run away from slavery, that was it. He could have said, I'm free. I'm just going to go about my business. But he understood that this was an injustice that was going on, and his brethren were still enslaved. They were toiling away in chains, and his conscience would not allow him to bury his head in the sand. And these are the same things that we need to do as human beings. I mean, we all have inalienable rights. And, you know, certainly I've come into contact with a lot of people, adults mostly, that will say, again, this is why we work with children. But adults, it'll say, this issue is just too big. I just choose to bury my head in the sand, or this is not happening in my community. But education is the first place to start. So in this case, education means awareness. And if this is something that you as a human being and your abundance of your human heart says it's not right for a 10-year-old girl or boy to be sold for sex 25, 30 times a day, which is happening in the United States and is happening in other parts of the world. So, you know, I'm an activist. I have the blood of two great heroes flowing through my veins, and I have their genes. So perhaps that's why I feel motivated to do this type of work. But, you know, this is a problem that affects the most vulnerable among us. And, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And this threatens our own freedom. It threatens our own humanity if we don't do something about it. Frederick Douglass also said, and I love, you know, the quotes, Booker T. Washington quotes and Frederick Douglass quotes. I use them all the time when I speak. But Frederick Douglass said, you cannot tie a chain around the ankle of your fellow man without, alas, finding the other end fastened around your own neck. So unless we as people look at issues like this and many others, you know, there are people that are passionate about other issues, and we need to work on all of these things. But if we don't do something about these injustices that we see, then we're really walking around with a chain fastened around our neck, and the other end is fastened around the victims that are being exploited. So I would just say, learn about the issue and then think about your own talent, your own passion, your own intellect, and how you can contribute to this cause. And there are many, many ways to be able to do that.
So then I would ask maybe what are good, rather than, as you said, focusing on specific, say, industries, what might be some, just off the top of your head, some great resources that people want, who want to get started, because you have to find a place to start or a few places. What would be some places that people could sit down right now with Google and whatever browser, not to poach one, but
Chrome.
Yeah, that's what I'm usually using, but whatever.
Yeah, come to our website. Yeah, that's course. A great place to start, which is FDFI.org, mm-hmm. and that is the acronym for Frederick Douglass Family Initiatives. And if mm-hmm. I may say this, you know, the Trafficking Victims Protection Act legislation of 2000 and its subsequent reauthorizations, which I think have happened maybe four or five times, every 4 years they reauthorize it, really shaped how we address human trafficking internationally and domestically. Mm-hmm. And our organization, we really believe that it's flawed in many ways because it only addresses what happens after someone has been victimized. Mm-hmm. So all of the funding, the resources, any strategy to addressing this is a victim-centered approach, which we're not saying that it shouldn't be a victim-centered approach, but it's 100% a victim-centered approach. So law enforcement is reacting after the crime has been committed. And then after somebody has been victimized, then the rescue, restore, and rehabilitation of that victim happens. And that is very, very costly to a community. There's been no effort put toward what we call primary prevention. Mm-hmm. The federal government would say that, yes, we are doing prevention, but the prevention they're talking about is preventing further victimization.
I see.
That's not the prevention we're talking about. We're talking about prevention education that goes into the classroom so that we can get out in front of this issue. And one of the analogies that we like to use to describe the federal government's approach to this is we all remember the British Petroleum oil spill. Mm-hmm. And we saw the videos and the pictures of the wildlife covered in oil, the oil in the marshes and washing up on the beaches, and it's destroying the seafood industry and the Gulf and the local businesses. And our first reaction as human beings, we react with our heart and we say, that's a disaster. We've got to do something to clean up that mess. We've got to clean up that oil. But what British Petroleum did to their credit was they put a camera at the bottom of the ocean, and they showed the world what the priority was. And the priority was capping that well that was spewing millions of gallons of crude into the Gulf of Mexico. And this is exactly the way we've been addressing human trafficking in communities over the past 6 years, or 16 years, not just communities here, but around the world, is we're reacting to the disaster. We're reacting to what we see on the surface, and we're constantly in disaster relief mode, trying to clean up the mess. And unfortunately, we can't put a camera into the bedroom of a 9 or 10-year-old girl that's being pursued by someone that is reaching her on her iPad or on her computer or on her cell phone, trying to groom her to be able to sell her for sex. We can't put cameras in people's bedrooms. So we believe that education, prevention education, true prevention education, is the way that we cap the well of this particular disaster.
So, wow, it's very, I'm trying to think of like the way that we would say implement that. So we have the education, we have to stop it at the beginning. One would be, as you were saying, to raise consciousness in people, you know, that this is going on. It also seems that another way would be to provide economic opportunities for these children. You know, before slavery even happens, they don't, you know, run out, capture them, handcuff them, lock them in the room. They might go to community and be like, there are all these people who are impoverished. There are these families who are desperate. There are these children who aren't. They're not going to school anyway, and their family needs money, so they just bring them into their factory, and then once they're in the factory, they subject them to these conditions. Same with sex slavery, young women, girls who don't have, and families who don't have opportunities. How would we how might we best go about these, providing these opportunities? It seems even that it would go before education. So a child can't go into a classroom if there are no classrooms and the family is starving, so the child must work. Are there ways that you're working on that now, ways you're advocating it, some steps that are being taken by governments and other organizations on that front?
Yes. Well, domestically, all of our work right now is in the United States. And again, that Trafficking Victims Protection Act, the TVPA, we believe misframed the problem of human trafficking. And in the public consciousness here in the United States, we believe it's really only or mostly an international problem, and that any problem we have inside the United States is coming back through our borders, where that's not the case. If we were to look at statistics, we would see that many people are Americans that are being exploited. With regard to your question about not being in classrooms here in the United States, the work that we do is focused on reaching them in the classroom. And we've just launched a big project for the state of California in partnership with two other nonprofit organizations, the California Attorney General's Office and the California Department of Education. It's called PROTECT. And we're bringing prevention education curricula and training to school personnel and other service providers and other entities in the community. And this will be ongoing education that will start in the fifth grade. Now, the statistics that we hear in the United States, the average age that a young girl is forced into prostitution is now between 11 and 14 years old. So unfortunately, there's a need to get this information into grades even before the fifth grade. But for California, we're it's going to be in the fifth grade, and that'll be a conversation with students around boundaries and family, and who do you let in your circle of friends, and what is a human life worth. And then in the seventh grade, it'll be in like a family class, and there'll be a little bit more information that will be given. The ninth grade, the bulk of the information will happen in the health class, where we'll really talk about sex trafficking and also labor trafficking. And then in the 11th grade, it'll be in a U.S. history class, because that's when the service kicks in. So once the students have had the 3 years prior of the education, now in the 11th grade, they go into their community and they work on this. So we've drawn a circle around schools for this project. But because the students are the ones that are carrying forward the education, what's happening is they're reaching other people in their family. They're reaching their peers. They're reaching people in the community who may not be in school, who may be in foster care, or may be in drop-in centers. So this education has a way of being able to help the overall health of the community, where you're reaching people that are not in school, but by starting in fifth grade, we're hoping to be able to get to them before they're running away from home or before they're dropping out from school, so that they'll have some information that will be able to protect them. Now, when you look at this internationally, certainly there are other issues that come into play, and there are many good organizations that are working on exactly what you're talking about. They're working on providing economic opportunity after they've been rescued. They're working on providing education to them after they've been rescued, teaching them almost Booker T. Washington's philosophy, teaching them a trade, giving them a tool so that they can become self-sufficient economically. So it takes everybody working together to get at a problem so big. Our focus is on prevention, as I've mentioned, and we believe that the best way to help victims of human trafficking is to make sure they never become victims in the first place.
Going back to the education and to the ideas of Booker T. Washington, Frederick Douglass as well, I see a connection with something I read that you also took part in, whether you still do or not. You were teaching a class in liberation theology, I read.
Yeah.
What led you to that? How do the ideas tie together? And it just what you were talking about, you know, liberating oneself through education as Booker T. Washington really was a strong proponent of, Douglass too, although he focused even more on the politics, perhaps. How does that tie together? How does that tie together for you? And do you still teach the class?
Well, before I answer that question, I just want to go back to what you said with Frederick Douglass, working perhaps more on the political side of it. One of the things that is not as well known about Booker T. Washington, while he was out there educating people at Tuskegee, he was also a master political strategist who was working behind the scenes, working with President Roosevelt, so that when there was they needed to appoint a federal judge to a position in the South, Roosevelt was coming to Washington and asking him who he should put into that position. So it's not as well known that Booker T. Washington was probably one of the best political strategists that we know in this country. And he was working very hard behind the scenes to make sure that the political process was benefiting the work that he was trying to do around education.
He was a frequent... that actually awoke a memory real quick. He was a frequent guest at the Roosevelts, right? They leaned on him quite a bit for advice. Is that true?
Absolutely. Yeah. Great. And you may know, or you may have seen in your study of history, that Booker T. Washington was the first person to be invited to dinner or to dine at what was then called the Executive Mansion. Mm-hmm. It was later renamed the White House.
Yeah.
Partly, some historians will tell you it was renamed the White House because of all of the uproar and fury that happened around allowing this African-American into the White House to dine with the first family and really showing African-Americans as an equal. You know, it was about equality. So yes, Booker T. Washington was very well connected politically.
That's great. Thank you for that. I had forgotten that great detail. You know, it's because, you know, the Roosevelts didn't get as far as they wanted to, but there are little bits that they tried, you know.
Yes.
But I'm sorry, I actually interrupted you what you were saying.
No, that's okay. Yeah. You had asked about liberation theology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And teaching a class at the University of Laverne, which is here in Southern California. Mm-hmm. I was very honored that in 2012, the University of Laverne asked me to come in and to speak at their winter graduation ceremony, and they conferred upon me an honorary doctorate, which I was very proud to accept, and they've become a wonderful partner of our work. Mm-hmm. And one of the professors over there, Dr. Rose, Richard Rose, who is a professor of religion and philosophy, asked if I would be interested in co-teaching a class with him called Liberation Theology. And we used Frederick Douglass and Booker T. Washington and examined their worldviews and their strategies and philosophies around liberation. And then we connected it to, liberation themes today. And it was a great class. And I know the students got a lot out of it. There was a book that we used that I think the title was called Frederick Douglass, The Precursor to Liberation Theology. And if you mm-hmm. haven't read that book, it's a great book. I don't remember the author off the top of my head, but that was one of the texts that we used. And it was, I enjoyed it very much. I'm hoping to have an opportunity to teach it again in the near future, but University of Laverne and President Lieberman, the provost over there, Jonathan Reed, have been so supportive of our work at the Frederick Douglass Family Initiative. So we're very proud to be affiliated with that fine university.
Can you give us a brief introduction to liberation theology? A little more specifically, like what is liberation theology and how does it tie into these ideas?
Well, the idea with Frederick Douglass and, when he was a slave on the plantation as a little boy, before he taught himself to read and write, he used to ask God. You know, he started thinking about his condition and his circumstances, and he couldn't understand why he couldn't do the things that he wanted to do. So he would ask God, you know, why am I a slave? Do you mean for me to be a slave my whole life? My master, I'm having a hard time wrapping my mind around the fact that he preaches the gospel and the Bible to me, and on Sunday he puts on a suit and he goes to church. And at church, he finds justification in cherry-picked verses to come back and whip and plunder and cradle rob, people that are enslaved. And Frederick Douglass could not understand that. It did not seem right. When he finally taught himself to read and write, one of the first books that he read was the Bible. And in the Bible, he found that God did not intend for him to be a slave, and that God hates injustice, and that God would want him out there fighting against injustice. And so when Frederick finally had the courage to run away at the age of 20 years old, now, you know, people will ask today, one of the questions that I get all the time is, well, these people that are enslaved, if they're domestic slave or they're in domestic servitude, or they have the ability, as if they're being forced into prostitution, they're out on the street, they're in places, why don't they just run away? Well, you know, we need to think about the mental bondage that they're in. And we can use Frederick Douglass as an example, as a very brilliant young man who was able to move around Baltimore, go to the ship docks and earn money and faithfully every day bring it back to his master. But it took him 20 years to have the courage to run away. And when he finally ran away, here's another quote that I love. He said, "I prayed for 20 years, but my prayers weren't answered until I prayed with my legs." Mm-hmm. So that's a message of taking action. You know, it's one thing to pray about something, but if you don't take action, then really are your prayers being answered? God expects you to be able to take action. So this idea of liberation theology is really understanding the importance of praxis and taking action around any issue. So we talked about, these types of themes. We talked about Booker T. Washington starting when he founded Tuskegee Normal School and Institute in 1881. One of the first things he did was he started a Bible college teaching teachers religion. And Booker T. Washington himself spent time in a seminary. So we just tie these ideas of, you know, religion and philosophy into themes of liberation.
I guess God helps those who help themselves, or rather God's help is the helping of oneself. Maybe they're one and the same thing for both of these men, it sounded like.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. So let's return to something we spoke of much earlier on, that you, when you were growing up, you were aware that these men, that Frederick Douglass and Booker T. Washington were connected to you, that they were ancestors, that they're in your life, but it wasn't until later on that you were really brought into their legacy through action. And then when I was reading about the Frederick Douglass family initiatives, that you co-founded this with your mother and with Robert J. Benz.
Yes.
Can you tell me about your mother, how she joined you in this endeavor, and then a little bit about your other co-founder, Benz?
My mom, you know, is a great story, because if you think about it, and she'll tell you, she pinches herself every day when she wakes up and thinks about being descended from these two great men. And as a little girl, she used to spend a lot of time around activities that it was then called Negro History Week, and then it evolved into Black History Month. And by the way, for those of your viewers who don't know the genesis of Black History Month, Dr. Carter G. Woodson recognized that there was no Black history in schools in the textbooks, and he started something called Negro History Week, and he chose the second week of February because it was President Lincoln's birthday on the 12th and Frederick Douglass's birthday on February 14th, which is the day that he chose to recognize his birthday.
Yes.
Because, yeah, he didn't, obviously, there were no birth certificates, and he didn't know exactly when he was born, but his mother used to call him his little Valentine, so he chose February 14th.
Oh, so, I didn't know that part.
Yeah,
I didn't know that's why he chose the 14th.
It's a heartwarming story.
That is so sweet.
So my mom was very active as a young child, doing activities, and, you know, you could probably Google search and find some photographs of her as young as 5 and 6 years old, and maybe even younger. I saw one the other day of her when they did the groundbreaking for the Booker T. Washington National Monument in Virginia. My mom, I think, was maybe about 3 or 4 years old in that photograph. So she was always connected to her legacy. But when she started having kids, when I was born, I'm the oldest of three, she became a full-time mom, and she really focused. That was her career of choice, and that's what she focused on. And then once we were old enough to take care of ourselves, she went back to work. She lives in Atlanta, and she's still working at the age of, well, I better not tell her age, but she's still young. And
she can tell us somewhere if she likes and on her own time.
Yeah, right, exactly. And so she, you know, she just went about her life, and on occasion, you know, she was asked to come out and speak to schools and groups, and she would do that, and maybe during Black History Month, go out and do 5, 6, 7 appearances. And I was, as I said, I was a businessman, and I have two daughters who now are one of them will turn 21 tomorrow, and the other one just turned 18 in April.
All grown up.
So I was happy to be a father, a husband, and a businessman, and really not do anything about this. And then Robert Benz and I have known each other since 1990. We worked for that gentleman that I told you became my partner. And then Robert actually started a business with the same person. So we shared the same partner. And so we knew each other since 1990 and for more than 20 years. And he was always fascinated about my history and my lineage. And I don't really remember even having a conversation about it. I don't know how he found out because I didn't spend a whole lot of time talking about it or telling people about it. But it was really his idea. You know, he said, we could take this as a platform and do something for the greater good. And we didn't know what that was going to be, and we just continued in our businesses. And then Robert read this magazine first, National Geographic magazine first. It was from 2003 is when he first read it. And in it, you know, it inspired him and to want to make a change. He gave it to me. I read it, and it inspired me. And so we really, it was in 2006 or 2007 when we started to put together the idea for this foundation that now is the Frederick Douglass Family Initiatives. And we went to my mother because, again, she is the matriarch of the family and wanted her to be involved. And she was incredibly enthusiastic and, of course, proud that now that I was embracing my lineage. And I want to thank her because she didn't force it on me. My father didn't force it on me. My parents, my grandparents, great-grandparents didn't force it on me. And I think because I was able to find it on my own, it's more meaningful that way. And so that's really how the organization came together and why Robert is involved with it and why my mom is involved with it.
Wow, that is great. I mean, that is a satisfaction that few enjoy, that to be involved with not only with family, with doing something of great social utility and deep meaning, satisfaction, and do it with family and a business partner. That it seems you are among the fortunate of the earth, but you've made it for yourself. That's very impressive and wonderful.
Yeah, I'm not so sure that I really made it for myself. You know, everything that I learned along the way, whether it be in the entertainment industry and then in business, I use all of it today. And I truly believe that it was a path that God was preparing for me. It took me a little bit longer to find this mission than it might have taken other people. But I can clearly see that the work that we're doing is I'm using everything that I've learned over the years. And I never imagined in my wildest dreams that I would be doing this work. It's not as profitable as the business world was as far as monetarily, but certainly what I get back in seeing the transformation in young people and how when they hear these stories that they don't know about this history, they don't know about Frederick Douglass and Booker T. Washington like they should. And then when they can look at the legacies of people that had it so hard and they were able to, again, through education, overcome seemingly insurmountable obstacles to rise up to affect change in the lives of positively affect change in the lives of so many people. To a young person, those legacies become tangible examples that if they were able to overcome slavery, there's nothing that they can't overcome in their own lives. There are no obstacles that are too great. So when I can see the light bulb go off in a young person's mind who, you know, previously told me that they felt like they were in mental bondage, that inside their head, their mind, they felt like it was a dark hallway with no escape, no windows and doors. And when you see, you can give them that spark of light, that hope, and to see how they can transform. And then Booker T. Washington said, if you want to lift up yourself, lift up someone else. And our young people now are taking this knowledge and they're lifting themselves up by working on an issue that's greater than they are. And finally, the last thing that I will say is Frederick Douglass's bicentennial is in 2018. And we're about to launch a program called 1 Million Abolitionists. And what we are going to do is we're going to get Frederick Douglass's narrative, which was his first autobiography that was published in 1845. Mm-hmm. He wrote it while he was still a fugitive slave. It became an instant bestseller, made him a celebrity. And really, if you think about it, that's the last thing that you want is the notoriety of a best-selling book when you're running from your master. But it shows you the courage that he had. And over the years, I've probably given away more than 3,000 copies of that book to students, and they've written back to me, they've emailed me, and they've told me how that book changed their lives. I've even had adults come up to me. In fact, we were doing a program at the California Department of Education last week for their employees, and this lady came up to me and she, with tears in her eyes, and she said, "I read Frederick Douglass's narrative when I was 8 years old, and it changed my life completely. And I also read Booker T. Washington's Up from Slavery." So in honor of his bicentennial, we're going to distribute 1 million copies and get them into the hands of young people all over this country. And then in 2018, we're going to offer service projects that they can do in their community. And it just will be about human rights, not necessarily just about human trafficking and modern day slavery. But, you know, our students are interested and passionate about a lot of different issues. So the idea is, in the same way that Frederick Douglass started to question his condition once he had an education, once he taught himself to read and write, we want young people around the country that are living in mental bondage to start to question their condition. How does systemic racism and institutionalized slavery, like mass incarceration and school to prison pipeline and the oppression that's happening in their communities, how does that affect them? How does it affect their worldview? And we believe that this book can open their eyes to the world that's going on around them. And then when we empower them with these service projects, we'll see, because we've seen it in the past through the work that we've doing, that the lives of so many young people will be transformed for the better, and they'll start to believe and think about things that they never dreamed possible. So that project's called 1 Million Abolitionists, and we'll be announcing that in the next couple of months publicly, so you're really getting the first opportunity to hear about it.
Oh, that is so exciting. Well, I am honored to be able to share your mission and your story, and that is a perfect way. I know you have some obligations that are about to take you elsewhere, but before we go, I would love to just remind my readers and listeners, please, again, introduce yourself, website, Twitter, how to contact, and most of all, how to get involved.
Well, again, my name is Ken Morris, and I'm president of Frederick Douglass Family Initiatives, and I am the great-great-great-grandson of Frederick Douglass, and I'm the great-great-grandson of Booker T. Washington. And the best way to reach us and to connect to all of our social media is through our website, which is fdfi.org, and that's the acronym for Frederick Douglass Family Initiatives. And from there, you can connect to my personal Twitter account, you can connect to the FDFI Twitter account and Facebook page. You can follow along teacher Barry Jurgensen's.
Yeah, so tell us real quick. Sorry, go ahead.
Barry Jurgensen is a history teacher from Arlington Public High Schools in Nebraska. Mm-hmm. He won History Teacher of the Year in 2014, and he's just a fantastic teacher. He works with his students to research and uncover underground railroad sites throughout the Midwest, and then he works with the National Park Service and their Network to Freedom program to get those sites documented and onto the National Registry. And so he inspires his students through action. And what he's doing right now, it just kicked off June 1st, is a fundraising project for our organization called Walk Forever Free. And he's walking 500 miles to retrace the footsteps that these two young ladies who were enslaved in 1858 in Nebraska City, Nebraska, they ran away from slavery and they made their way along the Underground Railroad to Chicago, which was over a 500-mile journey. And in order to raise awareness about that piece of history, he's retracing their footsteps. And along the way, he's doing events where he's raising awareness about our work and human trafficking today. So I'll be joining him next Saturday, June 11th, in Des Moines, Iowa. And then Robert and I will be walking with him the last 50 miles as he makes his way into Chicago, which our expected arrival date is July 3rd. So we're really proud of that. If you want some information on that project and to contribute to the fundraising campaign, you can visit fdfi.org/walk. And that'll give you all the information on that campaign and a place for you to contribute which we would greatly appreciate it if you would.
Well, Mr. Morris, it's been an honor and a privilege, and I can't tell you how fascinating this was for me, and I know people will be so thrilled and moved to participate in the great work of your organization.
Well, Amy, thank you very much. I've enjoyed following your blog and your posts on Twitter. I appreciate the opportunity to be able to share my family history with your readers and listeners, and also to share our important work. So thank you for this opportunity, and I look forward to keeping in touch with you down the road.
Thank you. Likewise.